If you want to track the economic prospects of a nation, you don't need to spend so much time checking out its banking system, its debt ratios, or its stock prices. You can apparently learn a lot about a country just by checking the temperature. Look at a map, and it becomes clear. Poor countries tend to be close to the equator. Wealthier countries are in cooler climates. Hot equals poor. Cool equals rich. Many researchers say this is a historical accident, but a new study finds a strong link. Temperature really does have an effect on economic growth. NPR's David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team reports.
This puzzle has been around for hundreds of years. The French writer Montesquieu thought about it way back in the 1700s. Of course, now we have a lot better data, and the numbers are striking. Ben Olken is an economist at MIT.
If you look at the data, every degree, 1 degree centigrade of higher average temperature reduces a country's per capita gross domestic product by about 8.5 percentage points.
That's a huge drop. He showed me a chart, and yep, cool places, Norway, Germany, France, the U.S., all strong economies. Then at the other end, there's poverty. Cambodia, Liberia, Congo.
It's a very, very strong line in the data. It really strikes you.
But who knows? It could be temperature, it could be the effects of colonialism, it could be just chance. So Olken and his colleagues said, look, let's forget about the differences between countries. Let's look within a country. Does a hot year hurt the economy? And they found something striking. In poor countries, a year that was, say, warmer by 1 degree centigrade, those years also had lower GDP by about 1%.
Which is an enormous magnitude. I mean, one might argue that the difference between kind of a recession, you know, where you have zero growth and a great economy that's buzzing along, maybe, say, 3% annual growth, that's 3 percentage points difference. So 1 degree centigrade explaining 1.1% percentage points, it's a really huge effect of temperature.
So a year that's, say, 1 degree warmer could be the difference between a recession and a more normally growing economy.
That's right. That's right.
Now, it's unclear exactly why high temperatures would have this effect. It might be that crop yields go down or that disease is more of a problem. Or it might just be what you could call the sloth theory. It's hard to work when it's hot out. Who wants to mow the lawn in August?
This stuff is not implausible. If you look back at the U.S. before the advent of air conditioning, you know, there were times when the federal government would shut down because it was just too hot out. One of the takeaways that I have from this paper is it seems like the economic impacts of increased temperature in poor countries are going to be very severe.
Rich countries, by the way, their economies did not seem to be affected. Warm year, cold year, it didn't matter. Maybe because of air conditioning. William Easterly, an economist at NYU, says the new study is fascinating, but he is not convinced.
It's way too soon to just take one statistical finding and say we've solved a 500-year-old problem of why temperature and per capita income are associated with each other.
Easterly subscribes to a less numerical explanation.
Roughly speaking, goes something like this, that, you know, by some confluence of factors that we don't have to get into, it was sort of Europeans who discovered first how to set up a sort of prosperous market economy. And so they were the ones who kind of hit upon how to do that first.
This, he says, was the huge, important innovation. Why didn't the poorer countries catch up? Well, slavery is one reason.
Europe and America benefited from the profits of the slave trade, and Africa was obviously permanently harmed by the slave trade.
The good news, he says, is that there are some countries bucking the trend. Singapore is just about on the equator and doing quite well. Indonesia is growing fast. And for Easterly, this is the great hope of global trade. Cold or hot, countries can adapt and grow to overcome geography, climate, and eventually their history. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. It's not a great time to be a smoker. There are new restrictions and taxes on tobacco. It's also not the best economic environment to be starting a new venture. But none of that is daunting to Ernesto Perez Carrillo. He's a third-generation cigar maker in Miami. And in the world of cigars, he is a rock star. NPR's Greg Allen spent some time with Perez Carrillo as he works with his son and daughter to create a new signature cigar.
This is Ernesto Perez Carrillo's laboratory, a warehouse in Miami's Little Havana section.
You know, this particular tobacco comes from Nicaragua.
Perez Carrillo has been involved in the cigar business for most of his 57 years. With his shaved head and hawk-like glare, he's almost an intimidating presence as he inspects some tobacco samples. These leaves of tobacco are what are called fillers and binders that will go into his new cigars.
This is all basically, you know, Q&C tobacco. And if you see the texture, feel that. Mm-hmm. Now feel this one. You see this?
Yeah, that's drier. This is more oil.
Exactly. Then you also, what you do, you also smell the tobacco. Mm-hmm. You smell that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you smell this one. It has a completely different...
Yeah, this has got a kind of a more distinctive
smell.
You know?
Exactly.
Not a lot of cigars are made anymore in Miami. Most companies have long since moved production offshore. There was a time, though, in the 1960s and early 70s when cigar factories here in Miami and in Tampa were at the heart of a thriving industry. But by the late 70s, when Perez Carrillo took over his father's business, cigar sales were in decline. Perez Carrillo wasn't making much money. Then in 1982, he tasted what he considers a truly great cigar, a Cuban-made Davidoff that a friend brought from London. He began a quest to recreate that experience with his own cigar.
Some people smoke for strength. Other people smoke because of the brand, or, you know, they like the band. I smoke because I want to feel not just the senses around my palate, but the whole body. And with this particular cigar, that's what I felt, you know. And then when I finally got the blend of La Gloria Cubana, I had that same feeling.
That cigar, La Gloria Cubana, changed Perez Carrillo's life. In 1992, it received a top rating from what at the time was a brand new magazine, Cigar Aficionado. In the office at his Little Havana warehouse, with his son and daughter listening in, Perez Carrillo recalls that he attended an event introducing the magazine at an industry trade show.
And then when I get back to the booth, I see a line of people in front of my booth. And I'm looking at those people, I say, you know, because it was a little booth. So I go there, and people start, hey, you know, I want to order. And I say, you know, what is this?
How many orders did you come out then from that?
That first day was $25,000.
It was the beginning of an industry-wide boom in cigar sales. La Gloria Cubana became one of the most sought-after brands. Perez Carrillo opened a second, larger factory in the Dominican Republic, and soon was producing over 7 million cigars a year. By then, his daughter Lisette was working part-time at the Miami store and planned to return to the business full-time after law school. But in 1999, the family got an offer too good to refuse. A big corporation, Swedish Match, agreed to buy the cigar company, reportedly for more than $20 million. Lisette says her family decided, reluctantly, to accept the offer.
It was a difficult decision for all of us.
You were a little bit disappointed. One part of you, though, was.
I was very disappointed. I mean, to me, La Gloria is still part of, you know, still part of us. I mean, all my friends, you know, that's the cigar I give out of my house. And that's the cigar that is just part of our lives for so long.
Lisette says she smokes 2 or 3 cigars a week, not many compared to her father's 10 a day. She's proud of her family's connection to cigar making, a tradition that began with her grandfather, who started out making penny cigars on Havana street corners. Among the people she's met, she says there's never been a stigma attached to cigars. In fact, quite the opposite. When I ask about health concerns associated with tobacco and the FDA's new authority over tobacco products, Ernesto Perez Carrillo says he's not worried. Cigars, he says, are a natural product.
You know, I've been in the cigar business since the early 70s. And quite frankly, I've never heard of anybody, you know, getting any type of disease or anything from cigars.
Dr. Michelle Block, a researcher with the National Cancer Institute, says the health risks are very real.
There is no question. There are definitive studies showing that cigar use is hazardous to health.
Block says cigar smokers especially have an increased risk of oral or esophageal cancer. However, she says health risks are strongly linked to how much you smoke, and that as many as 3/4 of cigar smokers smoke only occasionally. Despite increasing regulation and an economic recession, the Perez Carrillo family is excited about its new business venture. They plan to release their first product, a limited edition inaugural cigar, this fall. It will be a small business, they say, one of a growing number of boutique cigar makers specializing in premium cigars, but priced under $10. In charge of marketing research is Ernesto Perez Carrillo III, 27 years old, who's worked as a management consultant and on Wall Street. He acknowledges that in a recession and the current regulatory climate, starting a new cigar company might seem risky.
If we were trying to be a big, big company, I think we'd be very, very concerned right now.
But, he notes, last year 300 million cigars were sold in the U.S.
I think whether the market is, you know, 450 million, 300 million, 100 million, there's always going to be a role for someone like my father, who's just an expert, a master blender, someone who creates great cigars.
For marketing research, there are a few places better than Sabor Havana in Coral Gables. It's a cigar store and smoking lounge. There's usually smoke in the air and a domino game in progress. Cigar blogger and columnist Gary Arst quotes Charles Dickens, saying that with the rise of new boutique brands like Perros Carrillos, it's the best of times and the worst of times for cigar smokers.
We have the finest array of cigars available to us, but we are beset on all sides by taxes and by, I don't say they're anti-smoking people, they're people that probably don't enjoy their lives and don't want you to enjoy yours. They don't want you to smoke out of doors.
A number of communities are moving toward bans on smoking in public places outdoors. The Perros Carrillo family is ready for that trend as well. They're working at their little Havana warehouse to create their own retail store and smoking lounge. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
One of the big legislative initiatives of the Obama administration is the overhaul of financial regulation. And as part of the overhaul, the main responsibility for regulating systemic risk would go to the Federal Reserve. The expanded role of the Fed has drawn some criticism from, among others, a New York-based organization called the Investors Working Group. William Donaldson is one of two former chairmen of the Securities and Exchange Commission who chair that group. They released a report yesterday. It outlines their recommendations for regulatory reform, which differ from the Obama administration's. Mr. Donaldson told us that he believes the Fed should not have the final word on serious, risky business.
The Federal Reserve has primary responsibility and has its hands full in terms of monetary policy and in terms of keeping interest rates steady and keeping unemployment high. And insofar as you dilute that mission and add other things, you begin to move the Federal Reserve out of its primary mission area. So we favor a systemic risk oversight board.
A new board, you're saying?
A new board. And that new board would be made up of presidential appointments, probably four or five very senior, highly experienced individuals with a very strong chairman. And basically, the charge would be that they can have are authorized under law to go anywhere to search out where they see systemic risk potential growing. And when they identify that, then they turn their findings over to the proper regulatory agency for their attention.
But bear with me through a brief thought experiment here. If there had been such a board overseeing systemic risk throughout, well, if it had been in existence in the 1990s, say, until now, what would it have done that all of the existing regulators and the people at the Fed and the Treasury did not do to stop the country from getting far too leveraged and investing in so many risky securities?
Well, it's a good question. I think that one of the large mistakes that have been made here was basically the taking away of the authority for oversight from both the SEC and the CFTC and in the area of derivatives. So you had this explosion in new instruments, if you will, highly volatile instruments ranging all the way up to credit swaps, derivatives, where there was no regulation. And clearly, I believe that the explosive growth of these instruments would not have escaped a systemic risk overseer.
For people listening and trying to follow the whole financial regulation debate, what the administration has said, what your group and others are saying. What do you say to the cynics who say it really doesn't matter how many boards there are, how many regulators there are, and what turf they regulate, if they're all going to be drawn from the same pool of people who are going in and out of the same jobs and basically have the same view of what the investment community should be doing?
Well, I don't think they are necessarily drawn from the same pool. I mean, the SEC has, a very long and very distinguished history as a regulatory agency, and you have to look at the events of the last, decade or so with the explosion of technology and the explosion of instruments. You have to look at the cutbacks that were made in an atmosphere of deregulation. And this is to say, I think, that going forward, we need to attract more sophisticated, well-trained people to the SEC. We need to arm them with the technology and the knowledge to look around a corner and over the hill and anticipate the things that are going on.
Well, Mr. Donaldson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
That's William Donaldson, former chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission and now a co-chair of the Investors Working Group, which has released a report on making its proposals for financial regulatory reform.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
I'm Robert Siegel in Washington, and we begin this hour with the challenges facing two healthcare initiatives which could offer lessons for the nation's healthcare overhaul. In a moment, we'll check back with Howard County, Maryland's program. It's called Healthy Howard.
First to Massachusetts. It was the first state to mandate that everyone have health insurance. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, due to the state's budget crisis, Massachusetts is now poised to drop 30,000 legal immigrants from its coverage.
Since Massachusetts' health insurance program went into effect, the rate of uninsured here has dropped to less than 3%. That's the lowest in the nation, which averages 15%. But with state revenues now in a free fall, lawmakers say Massachusetts can no longer afford to extend coverage as generously as it has been. Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo.
These are a whole host of tough decisions that we're going to have to make. There is no way that anyone at the end of the day that I can look at this budget and say, you know what, we've been able to adequately provide for everyone.
Covering immigrants is more expensive for the state because even though they are in the U.S. legally, they are not citizens and do not qualify for federal assistance through Medicaid. DeLeo says the most vulnerable immigrants, such as children, the elderly, and the disabled, will not lose coverage.
I think on the whole, with what we were given as a hand, that we played it pretty well.
Governor Deval Patrick is pushing legislation to restore about half the funding for coverage of legal immigrants. But with state revenues down some $3 billion, Michael Widmer of the nonpartisan Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation says even that compromise may not be possible.
The state is facing a really desperate fiscal situation, and all programs are on the chopping block, and it's just pain, pain, pain.
Why am I losing my health insurance? And what can I do next?
Eugenio Hernandez, an El Salvadoran native who lives in Boston, is one of hundreds of immigrants looking for help now from the advocacy group Healthcare for All. Hernandez has been fighting prostate cancer for the past 2 years.
In my case, I need to see many doctors because my cancer is not cured. I have 2 appointments coming up this month. I cannot go without health care because the truth is, I don't want to die.
Hernandez, a janitor who works the overnight shift, says it's unfair to single out hard-working legal immigrants like him.
Yo pago mis impuestos,
I pay my taxes, I pay my insurance, so we contribute to this country. And then all of a sudden, they say we're going to cut your insurance?
Advocates argue that dropping the 30,000 immigrants' coverage will only end up shifting costs around to other state programs and to hospitals. Brian Rossman is research director at Healthcare for All.
A lot of the savings are illusory. We're not going to save in the long run, and even the short run savings. It's like a balloon. You know, you can push down on one side, but it's going to pop right up on the other side.
Indeed, yesterday, a city hospital, Boston Medical Center, sued the state, arguing that it's being forced to pick up too much of the cost of treating poor patients. It's all got advocates worried about the message being sent to those in Washington who are trying to overhaul the nation's healthcare system. Ava Malona is head of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition.
This sends the whole nation the message that, you know, the Massachusetts experiment doesn't work and health care reform cannot be done, or that, yes, it can be done halfway by excluding immigrants in the process.
Rather than discourage national efforts, Massachusetts' experience should only underscore the urgency, advocates say, for the federal government to come up with a federal solution. As one put it, all this proves is that the states can't do it alone. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.